I'm in the boardroom of the Mill Valley Library with Carl Mosier for a history interview. It's October 17, 1979. To start out with Carl, I'd like to get a little brief review of your own personal history, your education, what happened during the war years, and so forth. Can you begin by telling us how old you are, where you came from, and how you got here?
Yes, I will, Don. Thank you. I was born in December 1910 and in a little town in Kansas. Alden, Kansas, out in the wheat belt. But I think, very shortly thereafter, my father, who had married a young lady from the state of Virginia, he was very religiously oriented. Decided to become a minister. So we didn't stay in the wheat belt long. My father really worked in a store there anyway. He wasn't farming at the time, although he did a lot of farming. But very shortly thereafter, we went to Ottawa, Kansas, which is a town near Kansas City. The reason for that was that the Baptist University that was training most of the ministers was there, Ottawa University. He hadn't had a lot of schooling, so he was forced to really do sort of a cram course on high school before he could be admitted to the university, even though the standards then weren't as high as they are now. He eventually did that, worked his way with the help of my mother. She did all sorts of things, and he worked at various tasks and was a weekend preacher and so on to raise money. He did that through his high school training and through 3 years of college.
When did he bring you out to the Pacific Coast? You went up to the
Well,
Northwest, I think, didn't you?
yeah, that's very true. We did. The first move we made was when he left there as a junior because of his health, and we went to a little town in Colorado. That's going partway west. Hooper, Colorado. He also did a stint as a minister in Canyon City in Florence, Colorado, on the Arkansas River. Then we went back to Kansas for a little bit, and then along about 1922 or 3 was when we went to the Pacific Northwest, to the state of Oregon. Let's see now, his pastorates, well, he had one in Denver for a little while on the way, one in Idaho for a little while on the way, and then in the state of Oregon, it was Junction City and Gladstone, which is a suburb of Portland.
When did you come to California then? You had your education. You went to
Yes,
university
that's
in
California later,
California.
right. After the Oregon stint, we went back to Kansas for a slight turn. When I was in high school, as a matter of fact, and we're there about a year. Then came the trip to California, where I've lived ever since. This was 1927.
You came out in 27. That would be better than
And
50 years ago.
yes, that's right. And we went to San Jose. I was there as a junior in high school. And then to Ukiah, California, where I went as a senior in high school, not too long after starting. I started my senior year in San Jose and graduated in 1929 in Ukiah. I'd gone to 13 schools in 5 states in those 12 years.
Then you went to the University of Southern California, didn't you?
Well, I did after I would have been normally in the class of 1933, but I worked for 3 years, so I was in the class of 1936 at the University of Redlands, which was another Baptist-sponsored school in the town of Redlands, 65 miles east of Los Angeles.
Then after you got out of college, you taught for a while, did you, or?
I worked for the Security First National Bank for almost 5 years, 1937 till 1941. And during that time, I was doing some additional educational work, and I got a general secondary teaching credential.
Well, that brought you up pretty close to the war years. What happened during the
It
war?
does indeed. I was teaching in Compton, California, the fall of 1941 and the spring of 1942. And we know what occurred on December 7th, 41. Mm-hmm. But I continued teaching in the spring of...
you and I know what happened on 42. That day, but that was
Pearl Harbor when the war started, yes. Right in the middle of my...
Yeah, when the Japanese attacked.
My one little teaching stint. I was teaching at Willowbrook High School in Compton, which they have an unusual system there that actually involved the 7th and 8th grades and the 9th and 10th grades, which would be the equivalent of a freshman and sophomore high school situation. Anyway, I had a contract to go back and teach in June of 1942 when the school ended, but I didn't expect to ever do it, and sure enough, I didn't. I'd never taught a minute since. Because I went to work for the Office of War Information in San Francisco, where my wife had gone. We were married in 1937. She was a student at the University of Redlands. Her maiden name was Clara Hamilton. But her home was San Francisco, so she had gone there while I was, before the school period was out in 1942. Then I went to work for OWI, where I spent 11 months, at which point I was drafted, even though I was 32 years of age. At that point, we had a...
Did you have any children then?
Matter of fact, we did, yes. Our son Robert was born in November 1942. But that didn't count. I was in a small draft board in Redlands, California, and they ran out of people. So they started calling the older folks, and that caught me.
You served in the Pacific?
Yes, I did. I ended up, after doing a variety of things in the Army, in the Counterintelligence Corps, is what they called it, Special Agent. Counterintelligence is designed, to oversimplify it, to prevent the enemy doing to you the things you'd like to do to them. So I'd gone to Camp Ritchie, which was the Military Intelligence Training Center. It's near, not too far from Baltimore, Maryland.
How long were you in the Army?
Oh, I think it was about 2.5 years.
Mm-hmm. Then you came back to California?
Yes. I was in the Pacific Theater, and then at the end of the war, 2 months, 2.5 months after the end of the war, I was back in California and was discharged. Mm-hmm. And I had, at that point, my whole life shifted.
What did you have any definite plan of what you wanted to do when you got out of the service, or did you know what you wanted to do?
Well, I had a vague idea I might go back to teaching.
But you never did.
I had never did. In the 3 years I was out, during the beginning of the Depression, I had worked in a couple or three shoe stores. Very hard to get work then. As a matter of fact, I worked in two department stores, in the shoe departments. And the first year I was in college, I worked in a shoe store in Redlands. So I had some experience in that area.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And my roommate most of the time I was in college was Fred Drexler, a well-known person in Mill Valley. He's lived here now. But he came here when we graduated in 1936, so right. He's lived mm-hmm. in Mill Valley ever since. Mm-hmm. 43 years. And occasionally, because of our intimate friendship, we would come over here to visit them. His wife was also a graduate student, as was mine. They were sorority sisters, we were fraternity brothers and roommates. So naturally, we'd get together in Mill Valley. Oh, so sure. I visited here between 1936 and the end of the war a number of times.
And that's how you got acquainted with the community.
So I was very much interested in Mill Valley, and I had seen it in a spotty sort of way and loved it. And you asked the question of what I wanted to do. I wasn't just sure. I thought I'd go back to teaching, maybe. Matter of fact, I interviewed Mr. Wood, the superintendent down at Tam High, with the idea of becoming a history teacher at Tam High. But he was... pull up. He had no places at all in that department. And I was very determined that if I went back to teaching at all, he would be in the area of my specialty and interest, namely history. I had a minor in economics in college. And somebody said one day when we were talking, well, I know you sold shoes for a while. As a matter of fact, it was Jane Drexler. Why don't you start a shoe store in Mill Valley? We don't have one. We just have a little tiny shoe department in the local department store. And we had never had a shoe store, which turned out not to be true. There was one in the Dark Ages, but that's another story that we didn't know about. So I poo-pooed the whole idea and went on looking for a teaching spot around here. And nothing that I liked was turning up. And all the while, I was mulling over the idea of a shoe store and asking questions and so on. So I came over here and discovered there was going to be a slight game of musical chairs going on. A couple of stores were moving. There was a store at 32 Miller Avenue named Strawbridge's, a fairly new stationery store run by Gordon Strawbridge, a well-known citizen here for many years. And he was moving to Lytton Square, where Strawbridge's is now, all these years later. This was 1946. I was working in shoes again, because the minute I decided to do that, I hopped into a shoe store and went to work to get a refresher course. I worked for the Frank Werner Company in San Francisco, as a matter of fact. And so nobody was moving into the slot at 32 Miller, and Strawbridge's went out, so I made arrangements to follow him at 32 Miller.
Subsequently, you moved your store over onto the Lytton Square, almost, was it next door to, practically next door to the Strawbridge's?
Well, there was one spot. Yes, you're right. But there was one spot in between.
So for the most
to
of
be
your,
chasing Gordon Strawbridge.
You were a downtown merchant then, here for 25 or 30 years.
In my ownership, 28 years. Because
mm-hmm.
I opened in March of 1947.
Before we get into further discussion of your business, will you bring us up to date on your personal family situation, your number of children, and your marriage, and so forth?
Yeah, I referred to my first wife, Dawn, a little while ago. To back up just a little bit, when I was in high school and for the summer, I was in Ukiah, the only one I was there. I went to a church camp at Asilomar and met a number of people. I was there 2 weeks, young people, all high school kids who are just out of high school. And I met a young lady from San Francisco named Clara Hammerman. That was 1929. And we rather liked each other, and much to my surprise, when I went to Redlands in 1932, who do I find on campus as a fellow freshman, this same young lady. So we renewed our friendship. In fact, we went together our freshman year, and then, as so often happens in college, we broke up. She went with somebody else, other people. I went with other people for the following 3 years. She was once engaged to another person, and that was broken up in her senior year. So, and I suppose this often happens too, not long after we graduated, there we were back together again. Mm-hmm. We'd scoured the field and hadn't found anybody we liked better. In 1937, April, we were married. She worked for several years as a secretary to the business manager at the university. And then, as I say, pardon?
You got a family.
November 1942, Bob was born. And in 1944, April, our son John, or Jack, was born. So we had mm-hmm. two children. we were married for 18 years. Unfortunately, 13 months before our 18th anniversary, she suddenly became ill. Something which we couldn't imagine, because she'd hardly been sick a day in her life, and although she was past 40 years of age then. She looked about 25. Turned out she had cancer and she only lived 13 months.
That was a shock.
So that was, yeah, a terrific shock. And that was very early in 1955. And then almost 2 years later, late the next year, I had met a lady who was somewhat younger, 9 years younger than me, but oddly enough, she had a son who was somewhat older than my two sons, and we hit it off well. Jean Hollingsworth, her married name was Anderson, and she was divorced, living in Mill Valley, and so we were married. In the meantime, we had moved to 535 Summit Avenue, where we now live, and we've lived there ever since. Her son, Mitchell, I adopted shortly after we were married, and he's become a member of the family, and one that we're very proud of, and he's done well. He's a podiatrist now who practices up in Roseville in that vicinity and is very successful.
And the other two boys? What do they do?
Well, Bob is actually teaching school now, although I don't know that he's going to continue that too long. He lives in Fetters Hot Springs, which is up in Sonoma County, of course. He's married to, the maiden name is Phyllis Anderson, a nice young lady. They have no children. Jack is a general contractor and lives in Fairfax. He has two children by his first marriage. He's divorced. In his second marriage, he has two children by adoption. So there are four involved there. Mitchell has three children, so we have seven grandchildren.
Oh, that's great. And they're all in the Northern California area so that you can get together on occasion.
And that, of course, is a marvelous thing, which delights us.
Right. Let's turn now to the operation of... let's see. What was Mill Valley like during these post-war decades? When you first, it changed a lot during the almost 30 years that you had your business in downtown Mill Valley. What do you recall when you first came here? Were the trains still running? Or had the bridge been built yet?
You're speaking of the Golden Gate Bridge. No, that was finished in 1937. Although I came over to Mill Valley while it was being built on the ferry, and I can remember that, to visit our friends. Very briefly. My first really impressions of Mill Valley are mostly have to do when I came over here immediately after the war in 1946 and was thinking about going into business here. Downtown Mill Valley reminds everybody of something in Europe. Some people say Switzerland, some say the Midlands, England. It's kind of a combination of the two, and it's such an attractive choice place.
On the what kind of businesses were there on the square in this little community? You mentioned that there was a department store.
Yes, on the corner where Moody Blues is now, of course, was Albert's department store. They had a department store also in San Rafael in those days, later became Macy's. They were our only shoe competition because they had a department on the second floor.
You had
over on Lytton Square, though, one of the interesting things, Don, was the fact that instead of merchandising, there was a barbershop and a PG&E building, in these key spots. Mm-hmm. In fact, PG&E was where Strawbridge's went into in 1947, mm-hmm. and where they still are.
You had, were there any banks? There must have been a bank in town then.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, two, right where the ones downtown are now. Mm-hmm. The Bank of America, formerly the Bank of Italy there, I guess, for years. And I think it was... the other bank, now Wells Fargo, I think was American Trust, then, mm-hmm. if I remember correctly.
The savings and loans, there are two or three of those in downtown Mill Valley now. They didn't come in until sometime later, did they?
Until later. Even Northwestern, which I believe was the first here, didn't come until later.
How about the restaurants and bars? Were there
where Bell Savings is now was a restaurant and had been for countless years. Over where a part of the Mill Valley Market is, where the liquor store department is, that was also a restaurant in those days.
Well, then Quinn's famous bar was in that on that corner too, wasn't it?
Well,
at Quinn's, one time.
Yeah. Yes, that's right.
And for real estate office. Amil Poli, I think.
Amil Poli had a real estate office there, and an insurance.
That's POHLI.
Mm-hmm. Right. And as you say, the Jimmy Quinn bar was there for years. He also owned for years a bar that's up on Throckmorton. I don't go to bars anymore, and I forget the name of it.
The one. Or the
yes, that's right. That's right. That's where the Quinn place was.
Mm-hmm. What other kind of merchants were there in downtown Mill Valley in the early days? Service or merchandising businesses, do you recall?
I think one of the most conspicuous differences was the presence of Brown's, a very large furniture operation. There's nothing comparable at all now to that. Mm-hmm. In fact, he did business, Lester Brown did business all over Marin County, and it was a very sizable operation.
That was, in recent years, converted to what they now call
Old Brown's
store.
Yes, he's deceased. I don't know what he thought of the Old Brown's business, but I guess it was apropos. In fact, if he hadn't been there doing a big business, I don't think I ever would have opened a store at 32 Miller. But as it turned out, because that created traffic, in other words, that was beyond me, and I had the feeling that that would draw quite a bit of traffic from Lytton Square down. Well, it did to a certain extent, but his was not the same type of business, and it didn't draw enough to do much good. Mm-hmm. Miller Avenue in those days was very poor as far as the retail trade mm-hmm. went.
Mm-hmm. When you moved into what the lower floor there of the Keystone Building, who else? What other kinds of operations were there in the Keystone Building? Upstairs, there were offices.
Over the store and the whole business was the Rod Hartman medical operation, of course, for many, many years. I think that went all the way back to during World War II and maybe before. And then we had George Comstock, engineering firm upstairs, Bill Fleming, accountant. Bob Andreessen came in, I can't remember just when, as an attorney there. I think it was in the late 40s, but I'm not sure about that.
Yeah.
On the first floor, next to where I went in fact, the store that departed, in fact, I bought their lease so I could move in, was a children's shop run by Doris Powers. She moved out and we moved in. Next door was the R&M style shop, ladies' clothing.
What was Lytton Square like itself? Had the trees been planted in the middle of the square yet?
No, believe it or not, the enormous redwood tree that looks like it had been there since the Middle Ages was planted in the early 50s. Ruth Murphy, who ran the R&M shop, and I stood out in Lytton Square and watched them set the little tree down. You could pick it up in one hand, and there it is. No, there were just big bushes and parking. Mm-hmm. In the middle of Lytton Square in those days.
Now, the bus depot, the trains had not were not running.
I wouldn't say that. The passenger trains weren't running.
The railroad station had been converted into a bus depot, I believe.
When I opened in 1947.
Yes.
That's right, but they still brought freight in. and they had a siding up there. The freight was mostly for Mill Valley Lumber. They also brought in plumbing equipment, I think, for Varney's and people like that on occasion. Heavy objects, and also some things for Brown's. Usually came in at night. I lived on Miller Avenue in those days, and I will remember that, because the shuffling around of freight cars would wake you up during the night and be somewhat irritating.
What was your impression of the kind of business that was done here in Mill Valley? Most of the people were commuters to San Francisco working. Did they buy most of their, what kinds of, a lot of them must have bought a lot of things in the city, gone shopping in the city. Were the goods and services offered in Mill Valley, did they provide a complete variety of things, or did people have to go to San Rafael or San Francisco if they wanted to buy a suit of clothes, or if they wanted to buy an automobile, or if they wanted to do...
No, as a matter of fact, Don, I think it was more complete than it is now.
That's interesting.
Yeah, it was a. I think it was a carryover from the period when it was actually the ferry days, when it was actually a bit of a problem to go to the city, and most of the ladies didn't think so much of going over their shop. For example, the Albert Department Store and later Mayer's Department Store served great needs. Just to mention one thing that comes to mind, they had all kinds of bathroom supplies, linen, and blankets. Underwear, basic bread and water materials, you know, that every family needs, that are hard to come by now, even though we have a terrific multiplication of other things going on.
Well, in the early days, did you were there these boutiques and tourist type shops that Mill Valley has in downtown area now?
Nothing really comparable to that. There were some smaller shops, but they were run in a different way. The boutique, to me, has sort of an expensive luxury patina that these shops didn't have. They dealt also generally with elementary merchandise you need. For example, for years and years we had the Variety Store, Bennett's Variety Store. Still do, although I guess it's in the process of closing out. And if that should leave and nothing came in after it, that would repeat all the things I was talking about concerning basic clothing and house supplies and so on. There are innumerable things, thread and needles and all kinds of things that you get in places like this that people need. And if you don't have those things and are just dealing in expensive luxury things and gift-type things and so on, you have actually narrowed your shopping choices as far as family-type things go.
How do you account for this change of types of business in Mill Valley and the expensive boutiques that have moved in? Is there more money in Mill Valley now? Are there more tourists, or how do you account for it?
Yes, there certainly are a lot more tourists. Of course, anything as attractive as Mill Valley, this close to a large metropolitan area, is going to get a big play. And somehow the pattern was also set by Sausalito, which started many years before Mill Valley did, as to being something of a tourist town. And it's kind of spilled over and is up here now. Because Southern Marin is so attractive physically, of course, it's brought in a lot of conventional people of means. They've always been here, but it's added to that greatly. They've also brought in a new element of young, well-to-do people, which are exemplified in the drug industry, which we all know has been very big in Marin, particularly Southern Marin.
And there have been a fair number of rock band and entertainer types of young people who have moved over here also, I think, with lots of money.
Oh, yes. I can remember once about, 10 years ago, I had a call in the middle of the afternoon from a young man who said he wanted to be downtown around 5:30 when do you close? And I said, around 5:30. And he said, well, we'll try to be there by 5:30, but if not, would you wait for us? And I sort of demurred a little bit, but he said, no, it's worth your while, and so on. So I waited a little bit after 5:30, and an enormous limousine pulled up with full of people. I think there were 7 people in it. And they got out and came in and rapped on the door. He said, I'm the guy we were talking about. And this was a whole rock band. I forget which one it was, you know. And they came in, and I was there for ages selling shoes. That's what they really wanted, to come at closing time. And they lived up in the hills somewhere, and I must have sold them, you know, $400 or $500 worth of merchandise in just a little while. And to me, that sort of exemplified a lot of the things I knew were going on in the area.
As a downtown merchant who served families, practically every family in Mill Valley must have been a customer of yours at one time or another. You had an opportunity to perhaps to hear the gossip about what was going on insofar as various individuals are concerned. Do you recall being aware of that experience?
Well, I certainly did see a big cross-section of people here over the years, all right. We had many... as a generalization, though, I'd like to say that they're extraordinarily nice people to serve. I haven't mentioned the fact, but I opened a store in Daly City in the Westlake Shopping Center in 1952. Was there for 10 years, and I worked down there part-time. And as the years went by there, my time in that store got less and less. And that was because I was spoiled by that, waiting on the type of people we had in Mill Valley, mm-hmm. who were, by and large, considerate, nice, paid their bills, and were just pleasant to be around. Mm-hmm. It was very different in the city.
You got to know them on a friendly, neighborly basis. You were able to call them by name, I suppose, an awful lot of them. And a lot of them knew you and probably called you by name. It was not an impersonal
right.
business.
No, it had a village intimacy that doesn't exist now so much anyway. When you went to the bank in those days or the post office, you generally knew everybody you saw or practically everyone.
Mm-hmm. How about, has there been a buildup of traffic and parking problems that had an effect on local business?
Well, of course, everyone who lived here more than 20 years ago talks about that, because we have essentially horse and buggy streets in Mill Valley, even downtown, and we have this enormous influx of traffic. And as you know, one of the things that's happened here with all the young people who, for a variety of reasons, have found Southern Marin attractive, is that they have doubled up and tripled up and quadrupled up in the houses. If you drive down the streets in the hills here, you'll find just cars parked bumper to bumper. Every one of those represent one or two people who are living in the same number of houses that were there years and years ago, which were family dwellings then and had one family in them. And what this does is create traffic jams downtown, among other things. So that while you can walk across the street with fair safety without looking either way 25 years ago, you wouldn't do it now any more than crossing Market, hardly.
That's right. And yet Mill Valley today has, what, about three stoplights, one out by, four, one out at the Tam High by the Safeway store,
mm-hmm.
one by the middle school, one by Park School, well, I guess one at Alto.
East Blydale.
Is that it?
And the one at Park School, as far as I know, that's all.
There are none in downtown Mill Valley.
None whatsoever.
Mm-hmm. And there are no police directing traffic in downtown Mill Valley even today, are there? Except perhaps for a special event.
Exactly. So it is a hard place to get around in, whereas it used to be quite different. Mill Valley, you know, due to the terrain, hasn't changed in appearance all that much. There isn't a lot you can do with the appearance of a mountain town, in a way, particularly if you live in a forest. The houses are mostly hidden. The terrain prohibits building in a lot of ways, so it's very similar. The biggest thing we ever did downtown, and while I'm thinking of it, Don, I'll mention it, to change the appearance was put plant trees in the sidewalk intermittently, and to the famous paint-up campaign back in the 50s. The whole area, which was surprisingly similar to now, looks very different now because we painted the whole town then, and it's been kept up pretty well.
I guess the Planning Commission has controls over the appearance of certain types of establishments. It seems to me that there have been rulings by them to keep certain types of commercial architecture out of the village, particularly the franchise type buildings. Is this right?
Mm-hmm. Yes. There's been a big effort to keep things the way it used to be in the old days. Some of the buildings have been remodeled rather than rebuilt, and the architectural advisory people have kept the designs of many of them so that they're attractive, and I think they'll have lasting aesthetic appeal. There are two buildings going up on Lower Miller Avenue now, and while people laugh at them in a certain way, they're interesting, architecturally speaking. Have a lot of detail on them, and that's the sort of building I think that has character and generally wears well, rather than just a rectangle that's set down somewhere with a roof on it.
Right. As a retail merchant in a town like Mill Valley, I suppose you had opportunities, or were expected to, or wanted to belong to some of the local civic groups, organizations. There are quite a wide number of them. Which ones, if any, did you belong to?
Well, I belonged to the Chamber of Commerce for years and years, the whole time, of course, and I also belonged to the Rotary Club. That was the only social or semi-social club I belonged to. And that was interesting, of course, because a lot of us, small merchants, have to spend most of our time in our business to make it work. You don't get out and run around too much because your presence is required. So it's very nice to be required once a week to go to some kind of a public meeting like that and meet your fellow merchants.
Mm-hmm. From a the downtown merchants, on occasion, at least, were a political force in Mill Valley domestic politics. Who ran, or who does run Mill Valley now? Is it the downtown merchants?
As a matter of fact, that's an interesting question, Don, and it bears on what I was just saying a minute ago. It was always very hard to get merchants to participate, to go on the city council, and to do other things, because they're small merchants, and this was exemplified by me, certainly. I turned down that sort of thing year after year after year, because I worked usually six and a half days a week. I generally worked Sunday morning in the store, too, because I had things I had to do which I couldn't do during the week. I worked some nights. I tried to be in the store all day, every day. And a lot of other merchants, although some weren't quite that bad, were on the job all the time. And they had a tendency, understandable tendency, to just not have the energy to get involved heavily in that. For that reason, the merchants, at least in the old days, when you had little different type stores and so on, just didn't get involved too much.
Well, then what kind of men and women did take the jobs as or run for office as leaders in the community, political leaders?
Generally, well-to-do, precocious people who had offices in the city, but who wanted to have a political activity here. Real estate people, certain types of them, have always had a desire to get into politics for reasons we don't have to go into.
Well, real estate has been for many years one of Mill Valley's leading industries, hasn't it?
Yeah, that's right. Many of the desirable homes just simply don't turn over. They stay occupied for lifetimes But other than that, there's terrific activity.
Incidentally, on the matter of real estate, I'd like to have you comment on your observations of what has happened to real estate prices in Southern Marin County in the last 5 years or so since the nation has been experiencing wild inflation.
Well, everything we've said about the desirability of Southern Marin and Mill Valley and so on is the explanation for the fact that real estate has gone up here.
Do you remember what you paid
about as much as any place in the country?
Do you remember what you paid for your house? My house, I was told my house cost $3,500 to build in 1903. It's one of the older homes. And it might be worth $250,000 or $300,000 today.
Oh, yes. I wouldn't doubt it in the least. A good location and so on. The amount I paid for my home on Summit Avenue doesn't mean very much because I've changed it about 10 times
mm-hmm.
over the 25 years that I've been there. But all of those have gone up somewhere between 10 and 20 times.
Do you remember the
or more.
A few years ago, the old library in Mill Valley was sold by the city, it seems to me, for $18,000, perhaps with a trade of some other
something like that.
Property of that sort.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that I saw somebody has remodeled it into a home, and the last price I saw on it was somewhere in the neighborhood of $400,000 or $450,000.
That's correct. When I saw that sign, I was struck dumb. In fact, I parked my car that day, and I got out, and I hiked up the steps, walked around looking in the windows at a luxury dwelling, which was the old Carnegie Library. Matter of fact, almost 30 years before that, I'd been on the board. I was once chairman of the Board of Trustees of the library in the early 50s, and I stared and looked through the window where we used to sit, and I see these fabulous luxury fittings and mahogany walls and huge rugs and this luxury house, and I can hardly believe it.
As a resident and merchant in Mill Valley over these years, you became involved in numerous extra activities. You mentioned having been on the library board. You have been interested in the libraries from various standpoints, and you have undertaken activities, political and social activities. What, over and above your business, what types of things have you done?
Well, we referred to that a minute ago, and I was saying that most of the merchants, small merchants, just didn't get involved too heavily, except through the Chamber of Commerce in city affairs. They take a lot of time and so on. We had an exception or two, mind you, but on the whole, that was it. I didn't get involved in political affairs somewhat, though, in party affairs. I was a lifelong Republican until the Joe McCarthy period in the early 50s, at which point I bailed out of the Republican Party. And after that, for about 15 years, I was active in Democratic politics. In fact, I was once co-chairman of a congressional political campaign for the area and put in a lot more time than I wanted to on that. It was a killing job. I had no idea. It was when George McCabe was running. And I did things that other merchants didn't do in the area of politics. I always permitted political signs. I handed out pamphlets and brochures in the store, and that's considered death to a small merchant. For some silly reason, I had the idea that in Mill Valley, you could get away with that.
And you did.
As a matter of fact, I did, and fortunately.
Tell us a little bit about your work with the children, the San Rafael building and so
that
on.
That occurred many years later, just after retirement, but I worked for the as a board member of the Marin Child Development Center, which is a nonprofit United Fund organization, which has been in existence for approximately 15 years. During the 2 years I was on the board, we had the good fortune to be able to put up our own building in San Rafael. Since that, the school has grown, and it's considered in its field a very important institution. They train very young children up to the age of approximately 10 who have autistic and other similar difficulties. Mm-hmm. There's one teacher, usually, for about every three persons, young people, enrolled. So it's a very specialized school.
And your connection with the library in Mill Valley?
Well, as I say, I was on the library board in the early 50s. Mm-hmm. And then I've always been interested in it, working with the Historical Society and the thing we're doing now, working with oral history, things like that. I've always been a volunteer doing things.
You've been president of the Mill Valley Historical Society.
No, I've been vice president. But I've done a lot of work with it. Okay. I've been involved in the oral history program as chairman for 3 years, and have worked with it actually 7 years.
Mm-hmm. Were you active at the time that the history room was put into the basement of the library here?
Only verbally. Mm-hmm. That happened during the period when I was so involved with the school, the Marin Child Development Center, that I didn't mm-hmm. get in here. Mm-hmm.
You've mentioned some of your extracurricular activities, Carl. Are there others that you have had over the years that you might like to comment on?
Well, I wrote book reviews as a guest book reviewer for the Chronicle for 3 years at one period.
What kind of books did you specialize on certain types of books that were within your special field of interest?
I tried to specialize in history books, but it turned out I did very few. And the reason, I think, was that you always get the books that you review. And I have quite a library of books I got during that period. And there was a man by the name of Royce Breyer who was with the Chronicle then. He worked for the Chronicle. And he was at least a semi-professional historian, although he wrote a lot of columns and so on. And history was his hobby, and so he had a much larger history library than I, because he reviewed nearly all the history books. I ended up with just a variety of everything. Mm-hmm. And that was fine. It was very interesting. It took a lot of time, evenings and weekends, but it was sufficiently interesting, so I did it for about 3 years and then dropped out.
This raises another point about you as an individual. I've been in your home, and I've seen your personal library and know something of your interest in reading. It seems to me that compared to many businessmen that I've known, you have a far greater interest in books and in reading than most.
I dare say that's true.
How much time do you spend reading usually?
That's hard to say. I read sometimes two, three books a week, and again, maybe one. Lots of history and biographies, and some philosophy, and a few magazines, although not very much.
What magazines appeal to you?
Well, I read The New Yorker for years. Breakfast this morning, I was reading The New Yorker. Often do. Mm-hmm. And I get history magazines that belong to the American Historical Society, the Western Historical Society, the Mill Valley Historical Society, and a lot of others.
Mm-hmm. Before we leave the discussion of the life and times of the downtown merchant Mill Valley, I'm wondering if you might have some recollections of some more of the stores downtown that you might care to mention.
Well, I might mention the ones on Miller Avenue, because that's where I started in business here in the 40s. 1947, I was there until early 1949 when I moved to Lytton Square, where the store still is. Brown's, as I said earlier, was a very large furniture operation. And we also had a very popular barber shop and a couple of other items between there and my store. And the most important and interesting one was a very active plumbing shop, Bob Meyer, a young go-getter. Actually, he rented the whole building that I was in, 32 Miller, which is half of it. But he had a good thing going, because he put a wallboard divider down the center of the building and rented the other half. So the rent I was paying, and the other tenants there, took care of all the rent. He was rent-free, and he had the other half, which is all right. I didn't blame him. That was fine. It was an interesting place to do business, though, in a store like mine, because they had lathes and pipe cutting machines and all sorts of things going in the back of the shop, with only this wallboard in between. He also had some ex-soldiers in there right after the war, whose language was interesting. And you had a store full of customers, and they'd start up a pipe machine and then stop. Something went wrong, and you could hear one of these things. So, now, of course, a first grader wouldn't even turn his head. But the we were all a little more particular in those days, and we had some very interesting experiences.
I bet you did. Bet you did.
Next door on the other side was a hardware store, Tamalpais Hardware, run by Tiemann and Dukes. Tiemann had one time been mayor, and both of them were very active. They were older people, prominent in the American Legion, veterans of World War I, and they were prominent businessmen, and they brought a certain amount of traffic down there, although it was not a good place to be if you needed foot traffic in your particular business. The next to them, when I went in...
Pardon me, I can't resist commenting that a shoe business needs foot traffic.
Pardon me. In more ways than one. And two doors down now, where DeVood's is, was a garage. In fact, it was a large thing, and just after I started, it was done over a little bit, had a new facade put on it, and somebody came in who was carrying some off-brand car. I think it was the Edsel or something like that, I forget. And the Henry J. It was a Henry J. garage. Do you remember that?
Henry J. Kaiser?
Yes. And that only lasted a few years. And then we had the bank, the bakery, drugstore, and department store.
That was it.
Mm-hmm. But as far down Miller as I was at 32 Miller in those days, there wasn't much foot traffic, and you just didn't do very much. Mm-hmm. That's why I had to leave.
That, do you figure that has changed much?
Oh, yes.
In recent years?
I see all kinds of foot traffic down there now. Mm-hmm. Partly the fact that Brown's, which is the big anchor on the other end, is now a boutique-type place with many shops. There is foot traffic. There's no question about it now.
Yeah. You mentioned having been active in the Chamber of Commerce. What are some of the things the Chamber of Commerce did?
They had a tendency to take a position on nearly all the things... city affairs. This is one reason a lot of the merchants didn't want to take the time to participate over a period of years, like the council and so on, because they worked through the Chamber of Commerce. We had merchant committees and other committees to deal with problems that came up, mm-hmm. and the committee would make a representation to the city council and other bodies and so on, and that's how they did it. My chief involvement with the Chamber of Commerce was in the merchandising sales department. I was the chairman of the town annual sale for about 5 years. They don't have them anymore, but In those days, we thought it was necessary to have annual sales, and we used to generate a lot of activity.
Tell me a little bit about those. All merchants would plan a sale under a blanket name of some sort. I don't know, a festival or some such.
We had, one time, we had something called Cloverdale Days, and we used a four-leaf clover as motif, and everybody would have this, had the ads printed up around the clovers and so on.
Mm-hmm.
It was that sort of thing that went on.
Mm-hmm. Did these stimulate business?
Yes, they did bring in quite a bit of business, but they were an enormous amount of trouble to run, because owner-operated small stores have a long tradition of having kind of stubbornly independent people running them who aren't particularly cooperative. And they were hard to handle. And most people who chaired these things for a few years would wash their hands of the whole thing, saying, you know, if they don't want to cooperate, why, forget it.
Speaking back of the old times, occurs to me that you probably were acquainted with a good number of what would be famous names in the Mill Valley history terms. Let me start by naming one or two. We mentioned Emil Poley, for example, a little earlier. You want to start with him and tell me a little bit about what you know about him and some of his contemporaries.
Emil Poley, we mentioned earlier, had a real estate and insurance business over roughly where the liquor store is now, the Mill Valley Market. Had it there for many years. He was an enormous man, I guess about 6'2" and around 300 pounds. Terribly hard. Foot to fit, I was never able to sell him shoes. If I remember correctly, he wore a 13 AAA, which was really extraordinary for a heavy set man like this. Great, booming, heavy voice. He was a high-ranking naval officer in both world wars, as I recall it. And that's where the quarterback voice came from, I guess, which made him a rather intimidating type man. But as far as I know,
was he a power in Mill Valley politics or in civic affairs?
Yeah, he was a leader in the Rotary Club, fairly prominent in the Chamber of Commerce affairs. I don't recall he was ever on the council or anything like that, but he was a big voice around town in more ways than one. Interesting man.
Right. And some of his contemporaries was.
Hugh Rutherford, he happened to be a very good friend of Poley's, ran the drugstore that still bears his name, run by George Hoyle for the last 25 years, I guess, something like that. But Hugh Rutherford was in his prime when I came here in 1947, and I believe at that time was also president of the Rotary Club. I don't think he enjoyed terribly good health, but he was a very cooperative, friendly man. And he was your old type druggist. I know the town was full of people that were as likely to go in to ask Hugh Rutherford what to get if they felt bad as to call a doctor. He was a very helpful, nice guy.
His drugstore was just across the street and down a few doors on Throckmorton from Emil Poley's offices.
Yes, and they were long-term good friends, it's true. Another one who operated right in that area, long gone, deceased, was Bill Stone, who ran an appliance store where the branch post office is now. Had a lot of appliances
there. That's across the street from the City Hall?
From the City Hall. And he was in his 60s when I came here in the in 1947. Pardon me. But he was very active in city affairs. I can remember once we had a Halloween show at night, a village-type thing in Lytton Square. Somebody brought in a big flatbed truck, and they had some musicians on it. Bill Stone, wearing a pair of coveralls with his store name imprinted on them, was up there slapping his hands, acting as as MC, and all the kids in their costumes filled it in square and so on. It was a typical village type thing that you never see anymore. Mm-hmm. But Stone was kind of an extrovert and a nice guy to have around. He didn't last too long though. He also was, as I said, was in his 60s. He married a lady much younger and he had a lot of young kids, and I think the combination wore poor old Bill out. He was soon gone. But a real character in his day here. Yeah. Well, we talked about Les Brown too. Browns, you know, that I have spoken of several times. With this big, one of the things that always impressed me about Les was the fact that he was easily the wealthiest person around, really well-to-do. But he'd made a good share of his money out of financing all his credit sales. He didn't have to go through the bank and so on. He financed himself. So that while he sold a lot of furniture and appliances and whatnot, he made most of his money, I think, through financing. Mm-hmm.
He occasionally financed other individuals.
Yes, he did, in business for too. A variety of things, that's right, mm-hmm. including Mill Valley's practically only big developer who developed all the lower area, George Goheen. He helped finance mm-hmm. him at the beginning. Les Brown had something of the air of a kind of a slick dealer, but as far as I know, he gave good values, and his service department was always...
He had a full line of furniture and rugs and lighting fixtures.
Everything under the sun. Another one of those complete places you could go for anything for your home. Including, you know, a man who put down rugs and linoleum and repaired everything under the sun. Very important place.
Nothing quite like it in Mill Valley today.
No, there isn't. Another one of those things we miss. Well, of course, Bill Fleming, we talked about Bill having an office, second floor of the Keystone Building. He sold out a number of years to Bob Story, who is the present occupant of that area. He was my accountant, one of the first persons I met when I came.
You were talking about Bill Fleming.
Oh, yes. I guess I had finished talking about Bill. Wonderful friend and a fine man, as I say, who had a great reputation for integrity. Manny Gomez. Well, a town character. He was a great monologuist. He was one of those people who, I don't know whether he was born in Spain or Mexico or whatever. His first language was Spanish, obviously. And he could have lived 100 years in another country and never lost his accent. He was always hard to understand. And very loquacious and talked quite rapidly. Ran the jewelry store in Lytton Square for many years, although I don't think he was in there too much because he was a developer and a hard-headed businessman. He attended city council meetings. And as a result of that and his other activities, oh yes, he was in the Rotary Club too. So I had much contact with him there, and as a fellow businessman in the Chamber of Commerce. And as I say, he attended all of the city council meetings, famous for his malapropisms. He fractured the people at City Hall once by saying, after a hot argument and so on, he called everybody to attention. He rose to his feet. Said, now, after all of this, let's get down to the brass facts. And this was a vintage Gomez. He had a thousand of them.
That's great. Isn't there a street named after him?
Yes, Gomez Way, in a series of apartments or condominiums built at the top. Those were all put up by
him. Down by the high school.
Yes, right. He built a lot of things around, had several tracts of land. Did very well financially. He's now deceased, and he died a wealthy man. Oh, let's see. There was, of course, Frank Canepa, founder of the Mill Valley Market, one of Mill Valley's great business institutions. He started that in 1929 up on Throckmorton, up where the laundry is now. Was there for a number of years. He was there when I came here in 1947. Always famous for fine vegetables, good meats, and good service. Frank was born in Italy and came over here, I think, around the early 1920s. Get up at 3 o'clock in the morning and go to San Francisco to buy fresh vegetables. Did that all his life. Even after he was in retirement, he would still get up and go to the city and buy vegetables to be sure they were the best, and they were fresh, and they were right. Man of great integrity, and with a what we now think of as an old-fashioned concept of service. The customer was always right to Frank. And don't laugh, that's pretty important. Anybody who's been in a lot of the current stores who don't have that philosophy knows how uncomfortable it really is.
Right.
He didn't talk very much, but when he did, he had something to say, and he was greatly respected always in the community. Ruth Murphy. Ruth ran the R&M shop for countless years. As a matter of fact, when I was, in 1946, when I was thinking about coming to Mill Valley, somebody said you should talk to Ruth Murphy. I did. I went to her home and I asked her about a shoe store here. And she gave me her view of the whole thing, what she thought about the future of Mill Valley and so on. It was very cordial, very helpful, very nice. And I was happy eventually to end up as her next door neighbor for many years on Linden Square. We had a nice relationship. Her husband, Dove, ran the men's shop, owned that for countless years.
How do you spell his first name?
D-O-V-E, I believe. He pronounced Dove. I'm not positive of that, but I think so. He was always a chamber member and a fellow Rotarian. I saw him quite a bit. They were a fine addition to the community. One of the things, if we have just a minute, a vignette I remember in connection with the R&M shop, was once I was, they remodeled once while I was there. Oh, that reminds me, if I may back up again. When I talked to Ruth Murphy in 1946 in her home, her store, instead of being in the Keystone Building at Linden Square, was up approximately where the Accurate TV is now. And they were there on a temporary basis for a year or two. What had happened was that the Keystone Building, which was very old, had to move all of their tenants out because it had been discovered that the floors were just completely rotten and caving in, termites and everything else. So they made the difficult decision of moving everybody out, coming in, taking all the floors out, and cementing the whole bottom. And so Ruth went back and in early 1947, while all the other people were moving back into the Keystone Building. I just mentioned that because I don't think anyone had ever mentioned this episode before, and it was a great inconvenience to everybody, and it was a cause célèbre at the time. But anyway, she remodeled her store in the 50s, did a beautiful job. It was just a great store, and ladies from all over depended greatly on the R&M style shop as a place to go. Not long after they remodeled it, I was sitting in front of my place one Saturday, fitting a pair of shoes, and all of a sudden I had what I thought was an earthquake. The whole building shook, a terrific crash and everything, and it was terrifying. The customers in my store were just scared out of their wits. And it knocked the shoes down in the window. I heard them start tumbling down, the display shoes and everything. God, what's going on here? So I got up off the shoe stool and walked outside, turned my head to the right for my neighbor, the R&M shop was, and I could see what appeared to be smoke coming out the front of it. And I thought, my God, something terrible has happened. So I dashed around to the front, and the whole front end of the store was gone. And I'm looking, when I look in the store, I'm looking at the back end of a very large Dodge station wagon.
Wow.
Which had driven from the parking place immediately in front of the store, over the curb, smashed a parking meter flat, crashed through the windows and taken this whole big station wagon into the store. It was big enough, really, to occupy almost the entire selling space in front of the store.
It's lucky
Mrs. Murphy was trapped behind the counter in the back of the thing, might have been killed. There was a lady completely covered with bricks and dust, unconscious, lying by the car on the sidewalk. And that was the scene I saw when I came out of the store. I'll never forget that. It turned out that the man was in a rental car, and he wasn't used to automatic drive. It was a big, powerful station wagon. He had thought he put it in reverse, turned around and looked down the street, but he had it in low. And when it didn't move in reverse, he stepped on the gas. And the wheels spun and he panicked, went on the gas more. And that car leaped over the curb, tore the stuff down, went right through the front of the building, and then came to a shuddering halt, just completely wrecking Ruth's remodeling job, and of course scaring everyone half to death. It turned out that the lady who was knocked down was injured, and they later had a suit about back injury and so on, but she appeared to be dead, but she wasn't. She was knocked out and covered with debris. Anyway, that's a long story, and we don't need to go into it any further, but it also was a very interesting vignette in Lytton Square, I can tell you.
The biggest sense of excitement they'd had for many years.
You know it. Gordon Strawbridge should always be mentioned, the founder of Strawbridge's, the scion of the famous Strawbridge family in Philadelphia, the Strawbridge and Clothier, one of the world's largest department stores. And along in the, about the end of World War II, he started the shop, stationery, camera store and whatnot, down that I spoke of earlier, down on Miller Avenue. Interesting man, great sense of humor. He was very helpful to me when I came in. He cooperated in every way. When he was moving out and I was moving in, when I was starting my store, there was opportunity for all kinds of friction and arguments, but we got along beautifully. In fact, I eventually bought a house next door to him, and we were neighbors too, and we were always good friends. I remember Gordon once sent all of his friends a Christmas present, and it was, and this is vintage Strawbridge too, it was a year's subscription to PG&E Progress. Anybody who knows Gordon Strawbridge would understand that.
he was mayor of Mill Valley.
Yes, he was, and he was the exception to the rule I was talking about. Actually, he wasn't as dependent on his store as most of us, as you can well imagine. That had something to do with the fact. He was also very civic-minded. Later, for many years a resident, still, I guess, of Tiburon, and mayor over there, too. So he's always been very civic-minded. Nice
man. Do you think of any other old-timers?
Oh, I can think of a lot of them, but I think those are probably the main ones I think of right off the bat downtown.
Well, what's happened to you over these years is that you, in your turn, have come to be an old-timer in Mill Valley.
I'm what we call a new old-timer.
A new old-timer. you sold your business and retired a few years ago. Tell me, what do you do? What have you been doing?
Since your retirement, and have you enjoyed it?
I might comment just a little on the sale that you just referred to first. I decided about 1970 or 71 that I would like to retire when I was 65, and that would be in 1975. And one of the first things I wanted to do, I had closed out the store in San Francisco, here in Daly City, but I owned a store in Petaluma, Keg's, K-E-I-G-S, Keg's Shoe Store. thought to be the oldest shoe store for many years now in the state of California. It was founded in 1870. And a wonderful place, and it was a good store. It was a profitable store. But I thought the first thing to do if I was going to retire, once I discovered that none of my three boys wanted to be in the shoe business, which I discovered, was to dispose of that store. And there was a young man who I'd worked with for several years who represented the United States Rubber Company. We bought much of our canvas-type shoes and other things from the United States Rubber Company. His name was Bradford Brad Nail. He was a great favorite of mine as a salesman for them. We got to talking one day, and I finally ended up selling him the store in Petaluma. This was, I guess, about 3 or 4 years before I sold him the store in Mill Valley. So he got both of our stores. Eventually brought in his brother, Joe Nail. They have also opened another store in San Anselmo a year or so ago, which is a very successful fine store. And so I retired in 1975. It was a pleasure to sell to them because they're fine young men who conduct business very much as I did. And since the two stores in Marin County have my name on them, I'm very much interested that they be conducted along the same lines.
They've expanded the operation.
They've expanded it, yes, and they're doing extremely well. And anyone who knows them will be convinced they'll continue to do well. They're fine young merchants. It's a pleasure to have done business with them. But anyway, retiring in 1975. Now, a little over 4 years later, I don't regret anything I've done. It was a great wrench to leave the business that I founded and so on, because your ego is involved in it, as well as the fact that it's more remunerative than being retired. But I felt that the time had come. I was not in good health. I was worn out, tired as a result of great strain. I had gone into business undercapitalized. I'd been in business 10 years before I could really take a deep breath. I'd had all the illness problems in the family, the demise of my first wife, and all the other problems, and I was just worn out. So now, 4 years later, I, on the whole, feel much better. I've had a chance to do a lot of things I couldn't do before. I didn't want to stop doing things. I wanted to do different things and get a chance to rest and think a little bit about life and how I fit into things. And I found it extremely helpful, and I don't regret what I've done for a second.
Any hobbies?
Well, one of the first things I did, I'd never done any building of any kind at all, was to work out a deal with Jack, our son, who was a general contractor, to come and build me a shop. And I watched everything he did and picked up a lot of ideas and got quite a few tools during that period and learned a few simple techniques, so I've been able to build some things since. One of the reasons I wanted the shop was that I wanted to try and put together some musical instruments, which I did in the next 3 years. I built anyone who's familiar with the stringed instruments, medieval stringed instruments, will know that there are companies who sell kits, which are the components and most of the materials you need, along with the blueprints and instructions. They're very elaborate instructions. It looks like the phone book and so on. But what's required to do this really is an enormous amount of patience and a willingness to go over all this stuff, sort of figure it out. So I spent in the 3 years something around, I guess, 800 or 900 hours putting together a Flemish harpsichord by the Hubbard Company, which was a copy of one made in 1584 by a famous Flemish maker, and two Zuckerman instruments. One, they were also copies of medieval instruments, one a virginalist and the other a clavichord. So we have three different types. And they're all rather interesting, and this was a great experience.
Your wife, Jean, plays all of them?
Uh-huh, she does.
Are you a musician?
No, not really. I play a little bit, but I don't really understand music. You don't have to understand music to build these instruments, but you do have to have some tools and space and the patience to follow an awful lot of directions, which a good share of the time seem contradictory.
You feel that it was your decision to retire was, on the whole, when you did it, was a happy decision?
Extremely beneficial. I wouldn't change it one iota.
Would you, looking back over your business career, in the light of conditions, business conditions as they exist today, would you recommend to a young man to try to go into a retail merchandising business on his own today if he could get financed?
Oh, yes, I certainly would. I'd want, before I stuck my neck out to say very much, though, I'd want to definitely have the feeling that he was of a temperament which would make it work. Not everybody can operate on their own. Many people, nothing against them at all, simply operate better in a situation where they don't have ultimate authority. There's a peculiar type of strain that goes with that. And you have to be willing to pay the price to do that. You've been in business on your own for many years, and you know there's a marked difference. I've known a lot of people who were excellent employees who were never happy and never made a private business go. They've gone under several times. They just couldn't put the thing together. If I felt they had those qualities and so on, and they like to operate on their own, I'd recommend it very highly, because it's the way to go.
Right. Looking ahead now, for the next 10 or 20 years, what are you going to do with your life?
Well, I guess more of the same. That's an interesting question, because it's true. I had thought just recently that while I wanted a lot of new experiences when I retired, that I'd had quite a few. I'd put my finger into quite a few different things, that I was going to slow down on that for a while. I've been out of the shop now for a year. I've had help with gardening and various things. I no longer have that. So I'd like to try building some more things, and I'd like to be able to get into gardening, something I've never done. In fact, in the last year, I've gradually worked into that more all the time. And I guess the formal type things I'm going to slow down on, do less of, and give myself a chance. We've recently gotten interested more in church activities than we have been in countless years, and I've wanted to do that for years, to do some thinking in that area.
So you're really looking forward to your last years?
Very much
rather
so.
Rather than looking...
Very much so.
...with any dread or any hesitation.
It occurred to me not long ago when I was looking at a calendar and read an article that, hey, I might make 2,000.
No reason why not.
Be 90 years old.
No reason why not.
When I retired all broken down, I would have guessed I'd be lucky to live 5 years. Now I can see, if everything went well, I might conceivably make 2,000. So,
well, let's
stick
hope
around.
Let's hope it's a new Carl. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Don. Don, you ask if there is anything else I wish to add after thinking for a little bit. And there is one thing I'd like to comment on more fully. May I emphasize how fortunate I've been to have a good wife. In fact, we're about to celebrate our 23rd wedding anniversary. It's a pleasure to add that statistic. Thanks again, Don.